excused.
The court is ready to hear argument in 040537, Lilith Brainer et al. Versus Trinity Universal Insurance Company.
May it please the court, Mr. Scott will present argument for the petitioner.
Petitioner will have 3 minutes. May it please the court. First, in our case, it's a little different than the other two. But the first part about it, we are seeking prejudgment interest against the tortfeasor. And our original pleadings against both what was then the tortfeasor and the Trinity, the insurance company, our uninsured motor coverage, we were seeking prejudgment interest. In our petition, we asked for prejudgment interest. We didn't say who it was against and the one that we went to trial on. We also said we wanted all the damages, all the benefits, and the general relief provision in our petition. The Benavides case has ruled that where it's a statutory interest, general relief is sufficient for your pleading, and that's where we are in reference to that. Secondly, under the I have heard the arguments of good counsel on all these cases on these basically the same issues. Rather than just to go to a general argument, I think I'd like to maybe approach some of the questions I've heard the panel ask. To me, this whole case is to be decided on the interpretation of these statutes as determined by the public policy issued by both this court as authority and by the legislature. Those basic policies are very quickly, and I know, of course, the court's familiar with all these, but as in Straussner, this court is deliberately to protect the policy of the legislature. Secondly, is to protect the insured. Therefore, that's legally entitled to recover damages from the insured. That third, it's to provide an incentive to the defendant to settle the claims. And next, it's to avoid a multiplicity of suits. When you apply those public principles to these UIM coverages, the outcome becomes very clear. I would like to address perhaps, in our particular case, our situation is a little different in this sense. The Brainerd sued the tortfeasor, whose name was Premier, and asked then and brought its UIM cover, Trinity, in. The liability issue was very clear. Very quickly, there was a 50,000-pound old workover rig that was out in the field near Pampa, Texas, and somebody out in the field saw that the rim was nearly cracked all the way around on the front of this machine. They decided to go on into Pampa anyway, and when they did, the wheel came off, that machine went across the road and hit Mr. Brainerd on the wrong side of the road head on, killing him, of course, instantly. Mr. Brainerd was the patriarch then of an old ranching family in Amarillo. They were running a huge ranch, like 75,000 acres. These five children that are in this case were all their children. They wanted to have the protection of UIM as they understood it, as it said in this policy. So they bought on 13 vehicles this $1 million coverage. Assuming because of the tax problems, as we all know, that could come about with people in that kind of a situation. What happened was that we began the suit against the tortfeasor. We took 3 depositions of the people out in the field, and the other side, the tortfeasor, says, we give up. We'll pay our limits, $1 million. And we made a Stowers claim. Trinity agreed to that. We took the money down. Next, we said, Trinity, okay, let's try to do this case. Can we do it some way? And they said, well, number one, we don't agree there's any liability. You see, at that time, already some of these cases had come out saying that there wasn't any obligation to pay attorney fees. So they didn't have anything to lose to deny liability.
Let me interrupt you there.
Yes, sir.
The jury was informed of the $1 million payment?
The $1 million payment? No.
It's just a coincidence that they come back with the verdict of $1,010,000?
That's correct. They were not even informed as an insurance company.
So all the jury was told this is Brainerd versus the driver or Premier.
That's correct. And I see a real distinction in this case where we're suing our first-party contract carrier as opposed to a tortfeasor. If we were suing the tortfeasor, they may have held off and determine when the liability is issued.
I don't want to interrupt you on your argument about how strong your liability was, but obviously the insurance company was closer on its estimate of damages, since in fact the jury came back exactly 10,000, exactly 1% above what you had already received.
I disagree, and I'll tell you why. Kavner says that prejudgment interest should be as damages. If you take prejudgment interest, when we took the $1 million down, there was still $90,000 owing on prejudgment interest as of that time that has never been paid. And we're entitled to that as damages under the statute. One. Two.
Actual damages. The insurance company was exactly 1% off of what your actual damages were.
I consider prejudgment interest as actual damages.
Perhaps you're the only one in the state then.
I heard what you're saying.
Under any tort reform statute, anything else you're aware of where prejudgment interest is not something different from actual economic damages?
Well, sir, that may be in under some other law, but not these cases and not this statute. And if that's the such. But in going forward with it on the amount of the damages, I want to talk about if you apply those policies clearly. Why shouldn't the tortfeasor, the insurance company, be encouraged to settle before the case was tried? After they denied liability, we took another 17 depositions. We appointed six expert witnesses and tried the case for a week. I promise you, the attorney's fees of $100,000 in this case is, in my opinion, woefully low. But that's what they determined, and that's what the court awarded. But we followed every point in 38001. There was the presentment. There was the denial of the claim. It was not paid. We had proved it to the court. There was a jury finding and a judgment on attorney fees. And yet it was still denied, because they're saying it wasn't due until this jury verdict under some of the Court of Appeals opinions. That makes no sense legally.
If it had been Premier's insurer, they wouldn't have owed you any attorney's fees. Prejudgment interest, yes. Attorney's fees, no.
I agree with that. If they had admitted liability and or we were trying to get the court fees, either one.
If Premier insurer had denied liability, even though it was staring them in the face, they wouldn't have owed you attorney's fees, because it's a tort case and you can't get attorney's fees in tort cases.
That's correct, but neither did I pay a premium. And I want to talk about that. In 2003, there was $111 billion paid by the citizens of the state of Texas for automobile insurance.
How was the insurer legally obligated to pay before there is a determination made in a contested case?
The legally entitled is obviously after a final judgment, Your Honor, Justice Jefferson. But if as any other contract case, if you follow these policies to encourage them to settle it, to give the insured all that he should know, and to stop the multiplicity of suits, somebody's going to suffer, either the insurance company or the individual. We paid the premiums, and we should be entitled to the benefit of that doubt. They're the insurance company. We're not in pari delicto with the insurance company. They have a whole raft of adjusters and people to examine it.
But
they have blue sheets.
But we also have to look at the other side of it. The company here has the right, if it wants, to submit this case to a jury. If they disagree, the parties, which often happens, they disagree, the legal obligation doesn't arise until at least there's a verdict, perhaps final judgment, and to go further down the line until the appellate remedies are extinguished. So why should they have that obligation before they have their day in court?
They don't have an obligation because they're not in an obligation until they're proven to be wrong. And that's in a court of law. Just like any other contract case, if they're proven to be wrong, they ought to pay the price. They're a lot better shape than Mrs. Brainerd was to determine what was the legal damages or legally entitled to or the amount of liability. And if you don't do that, Your Honor, if you go the other way and you say there's not any liability until a jury verdict, why a jury verdict? Why not a final judgment? This case this accident happened in 1999. This is 2005, and I promise you this case has been pushed as fast as we could push it. If you double that in order to do the other side, you know, it's not ever going to happen. Besides, on a $25,000 policy, it'll never happen. What you're fixing to do if you do that is do away with any UIM coverage, because the insurance company, just like in this case, is going to deny clear liability. They're going to deny the prejudgment interest. I want to talk about double recovery.
Why would they do that if there's a provision under that the insurer could go against for unfair claim practices or failure to defend the claim properly?
That's going to encourage multiplicity of suits. We then have to turn around and sue under 2121 or 2155 instead of this case. Why not encourage them to settle the case just like any other contract, back when at the beginning? And I agree with, I can see a difference. In this case, we were suing Trinity after we had taken down on a Stowers claim against the regular tortfeasor. At that point, they knew pretty well there was liability, and we could argue about the damages. There's all this state is filled with a huge industry of people who determine the value of these unliquidated damages. What's the difference between this and a lost profit, or a lost business, or a disfigurement claim, particularly, or the on and on things that are unliquidated and are not agreed to? Everybody should be entitled and have the right to have their day in court. But if they're wrong, if the policy of this case is determined by the legislature, that policy should be followed. If that policy is followed, as in this case, it's clear that we get attorney fees that encourages them to settle it. It's clear that we get prejudgment interest as damages. Otherwise, they have a free ride. Guess what they're going to do? Nothing.
Counsel, you're making it sound awfully simple when we've got several courts of appeals that have said one thing and several courts of appeals that have said something different. It can't be that awfully clear, can it?
It is to me.
It is to you.
Any further questions?
I assume your relevant contract language is the same as in the other two cases, that the insurers will pay damages which are covered, which a covered person is legally entitled to recover. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. Under the liberal construction of the finance code.
I haven't asked a question yet.
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you did. I apologize. Excuse me.
I did ask a question. You answered it. Next question is, when does a breach occur if the language is that the insurer must pay damages which a covered person is legally entitled to recover? Is that only when the insurer doesn't pay after there's a legal entitlement to recover? Is that when a breach occurs?
The breach occurs the same as any other written contract, and it's as finally determined by a court. It may be argued about whether it is in the beginning of the case, but what finally happens in the court and the trial will determine who's legally entitled, and then only on a final judgment, not a jury verdict.
Well, I don't know that we can apply such a blanket rule. Contracts are breached when their terms aren't followed, and contracts differ. This contract says insurer will pay damages which a covered person is legally entitled to recover. It could have said which a covered person presents for recovery. It says legally entitled to recover. Isn't that important?
Well, I think it's important in this sense, right? If it said presented, that would give a blank check to the plaintiff.
I'm not
instead
sure if it
of a legally
I'm not sure
entitled
if it would or it wouldn't, but the point is, don't we have to enforce the contract that the parties entered, regardless of which way this comes out?
I think the contract has to be enforced, but it's just like any other written contract, like a fire insurance claim. You don't know how much it is until you get through trying the case. Sometimes you don't know liability because they'll claim arson.
But the parties could have agreed that I have an obligation to pay when you present the claim.
Well,
or the parties could agree I have an obligation to pay when there's a legal entitlement for you to recover. Those are different things, aren't they?
Yes, sir, they are. And what the
we have to pay attention to that in interpreting this contract. Between
what the legislature did in this case was say legally entitled, and then it said it to be liberally construed in favor of the insured for him to get his money, and it also says that it's to prevent a multiplicity of lawsuits. And following those two public policies as dictated by the legislature, who heard all those facts like I was talking about earlier and got into it in great detail, and are in a much better position to make that determination than a court would be on individual cases.
Any further questions?
Yes, thank you. What was your comment going to be about the liberal construction of the finance code?
The liberal construction of the finance code, Your Honor, Judge Justice Medina, is that it shall be legally entitled to recover as damages from owners or operators because of bodily injury or property damage. They want you to restrict bodily injury and property damage to just exactly that, when it's to have a liberal construction in favor of the insured to get everything he's entitled to as stated in the policy of the legislature. If you only had bodily injury, you wouldn't even have wrongful death. You wouldn't have a whole lot of other things. But you would have mental anguish or these other intangibles that are still legal damages in the state of Texas.
Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Mr. Abe will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. With respect to the issue of prejudgment interest, we believe that this case presents essentially two issues. The broad issue is prejudgment interest recoverable under Texas law, Kavanaugh-type prejudgment interest, under a UM policy. There's a second issue here, a more narrow issue, is prejudgment interest recoverable under the facts of this case. I'd like to take the easy issue first and quickly. It's not recoverable in this case for essentially three simple reasons. The Brainerds didn't plead it as an element of damage allegedly caused to them by the tortfeasor.
Why does it have to be pled if you read the policy, include all damages that they're legally entitled to recover?
Simply because the contract may allow a party to recover or obligate an insurance company to pay a certain amount, it does not allow a party to simply get damages they don't plead. I believe the pleading rules of this state require you to file a pleading which gives fair notice of the nature of the damages you're seeking against your adversary. The second issue that prejudgment interest isn't owed here is because Trinity, to borrow from Justice Brister a little bit earlier, got it a little bit wrong. They offered $50,000, and it turned out they owed $5,000 in actual damages. Admittedly, they offered 10 times the actual damages that were ultimately determined to be uninsured or uncompensated by personal injury protection. The third issue of why prejudgment interest isn't recoverable here is the Brainerd's insistence that this court award them, just as they did in the trial court and the Court of Appeals, $263,000 in prejudgment interest for money they had in their pocket all along. The standard of review is abuse of discretion. To say that the trial court, given those three facts, abused its discretion is simply wrong. That decision is unassailable. Well, let's look at the broader, more perhaps complex issue of prejudgment interest. Is it covered under a UM policy in the state of Texas? And I think it's incumbent upon me to point out something that hasn't come up yet in any of the arguments we've heard preceding this, and that's that if the court happens to take a look at the standard personal auto policy approved by the State Board of Insurance, which is now used in Texas, it has been changed slightly as it relates to this issue. In the liability portion of the policy, the State Board of Insurance has now decided to say and add a sentence that says damages includes prejudgment interest. There's no such sentence in our policy, and there's no such sentence added to the UM carrier under the new standard personal auto policy.
If they had gone to judgment against the tortfeasor in this case, the judgment would have included prejudgment interest, would it not?
Yes, it would have, Your
And Honor. Wouldn't you be liable up to your policy limits
no,
for
we
that
would
judgment?
Not. No, we would not, Your
Why not?
Honor. Well, as this court pointed out in Embry in footnote 5, it has never been the holding of this court that prejudgment interest constitutes damages because of bodily injury. And again, what is this cuts to the question that Justice Johnson was getting at, and this notion of what is damages because of bodily injury, or if we look at our policy, Section D, the limits of insurance, which says the maximum we will pay is the stated amount for bodily injury.
He's legally obligated to pay because of bodily injury.
That is correct.
and legally obligated to pay usually includes prejudgment interest.
It is an incidental damage amount or incidental sum which is awarded in conjunction with a judgment against a tortfeasor. That is absolutely correct. But in our opinion, it is not damages because of bodily injury. This court in Ranzau, 1972. This court in Briggs, 1974. This court in Streisner, in 1989, says what UM compensates for is actual damages. Actual damages does not include prejudgment interest. That's an explicit holding out of the first court of appeals, I believe, in 1992 in the Terrace Bayou case. That's an incidental amount. Surely, yes, you are entitled to it against the tortfeasor on a judgment you obtain against a tortfeasor. But that doesn't mean it's the actual damages that you recover because of bodily injury. And I think that takes us, Justice Owen, exactly to the analysis that is required to look at. We don't think that the contract language covers prejudgment interest. We think on its face it does not. But if we pull back the curtain and look at prejudgment interest, Kavanaugh is an important piece of the puzzle. But we got to look further back. We got to go back to the 1800s. We have to look at the Heidenheimer case. We got to look at the Watkins case, which is exactly what the Supreme Court focused in on Kavanaugh. What is prejudgment interest for? Well, time and time again, the court has identified it as a form of penalty for the wrongful detention of money. That has become a characterized in a different way in the modern cases. Let me read to the court from Watkins. That's 40 Southwest 11. Interest may be assessed as damages when necessary to indemnify the party for an injury inflicted by his adversary. Stepping forward to 1978, the Phillips Petroleum versus Stahl case, which again is key to Kavanaugh, which is really was the guts of Kavanaugh. A defendant is liable for interest on the delayed payments of an element of equitable principle that Phillips ought not to be able to use someone else's money as it pleases for 10 years, thereby enjoying a very considerable benefit and then paying nothing for the use of that money. And more recently, the CNH Nationwide decision. And I'm reading from page 327 of that court's decision. In operation, it being prejudgment interest, would penalize only a defendant who is adjudged to be a tortfeasor and who did not make an adequate and timely offer of settlement to the plaintiff. So this idea of prejudgment interest has at its very roots in this notion of penalty. It's also in Johnson and Higgins. It's repeated. It's
and yet haven't we interpreted at least a former version of the finance code to permit recovery of prejudgment interest on future damages?
That was the holding of CNH Nationwide.
How's that consistent with what you're...
Well, the legislature undid that, as I understand it, because it didn't agree with it. And to quote the absent Justice Heck's dissent in CNH Nationwide, it makes little sense to award prejudgment interest against a defendant for a sum it has been determined not to legally owe yet. That's exactly what we have with UM. That's exactly what the holding of this court is in Henson. It is a sum you do not yet legally owe. Again, the idea here is embodied in this notion of penalty. Same concept as punitive damages. It makes no sense to penalize the UM carrier for this person who has, in essence, a conflict with it, the tortfeasor, for the tortfeasor's wrongful detention of money. Just as it makes no sense to impose punitive damages on a UM carrier for the tortfeasor's conduct. Both are punitive. What's the other public policy argument that's identified by this court for equitable prejudgment interest? And I say that to remind the court that we keep referring to the finance code. This is not a tort action. This is a hybrid case, but it exists and predicated on the existence of a contract. The prejudgment interest statute doesn't get the plaintiff anywhere because there is no judgment here in a tort action. But even if there were, let's look at what the other identified public policy justification for prejudgment interest is, according to Kavanaugh, CNH Nationwide, Johnson and Higgins and the other precedents of this court. It is to encourage settlements. I believe, as Justice Abbott put it, it's to expedite settlements, and it's to expedite settlements and trials.
Well, wouldn't it, awarding attorney's fees here, expedite the insurance carrier to move rather than to stall on trying to resolve these claims?
I don't believe that the Justice Medina, the award of attorney's fees should ever be looked at as some type of incentive to create settlement. I believe that, as State Farm and the initial argument Nickerson pointed out, there are other ways for that to be remedied, and prejudgment interest potentially could be. And so I would make that distinction. In other words, attorney's fees are awarded and by statute only. They can never be awarded unless there's a statute enabling their award. And they are only awarded where there is a just amount owed, where there is no condition proceeding to a contractual obligation to pay. But if I could use your question to go to prejudgment interest as an incentive to settle, that incentive idea in the law, as expressed in Kavanaugh and the subsequent cases, works perfectly in the direct action of claimant against adversary, the tortfeasor. How does that work here? Well, actually, it takes that incentive notion and completely puts it on its head, because if prejudgment interest is recoverable for the wrongful detention of money by the tortfeasor, and as was pointed out, I believe, by Justice Owen or Justice Wainwright, the UM carrier can't control when the tortfeasor or when the claimant settles with the tortfeasor, then all of a sudden a huge incentive to delay settlement is created. The longer they wait to settle their claim against the tortfeasor, what happens? The prejudgment interest clock runs. So exactly the objective of this court, as expressed in Kavanaugh, to settle, is 100% defeated if prejudgment interest is used or applied in this case. Again, that goes to the very nature of what UM is. UM-UIM coverage is a hybrid type of claim. It is to enable you to recover certain damages that you could have recovered against a tortfeasor. It is a hybrid claim at its very nature. It is not, it cannot be thought of as a simple wholesale or blanket extension of whatever damage you might put a lick on the tortfeasor for. We're standing here to write the check. That's not what UM is about. That's not what its purpose is. There's a lot of, I believe all sides to this issue grapple with what is UM, what's its purpose. There have been some laudable, broad statements in the law that say what it is, what it's not. We believe that the El Paso Court of Appeals in 1992, in a case called Casualty Reciprocal Insurance Exchange versus Dimock, 130 Southwest 3rd, 740, put it best, and it was citing and relying on this court's decision in Francis. The purpose of UIM protection is to protect the insured against negligent, financially irresponsible motorists by allowing the insured to collect damages for bodily injury. It isn't for allowing this recovery of all other types of incidental damages, because those damages, like prejudgment interest, like attorney's fees, have a very separate and distinct purpose and policy behind them, which is not present in this context, and in fact, which accomplishes or defeats the very opposite of the purpose which is outlined for the purposes of those issues. Again, prejudgment interest, I believe, is the focal point of our case. The issue of attorney's fees is also present in our case, but I'm loath to repeat a lot of the arguments which have been made already to this court, which are that Hinton is simply inconsistent with that notion. And with all due respect, this court will have to reverse Hinson if it is going to say that there is not the condition proceeding to coverage prior to a legal adjudication of liability and damages, but nevertheless, you can get attorney's fees because they went through the exercise of having to prove their liability and damages as with respect to the tortfeasor. And one last statement I'd like to offer in response to a question that came up with respect to Norris. The issue with respect to prejudgment interest and attorney's fees, as it exists in this case, happens to be in the underinsured motorist context. The answer to that question is the same whether you're talking about the uninsured or underinsured context. The policy language is the exact same. The answer is the exact same, and the justifications for the answer being exactly as the Amarillo Court of Appeals concluded is the same. That was a just result. Awarding the Brainerds $263,000 in prejudgment interest on money they had all in their pocket virtually the entire time against the UM carrier is not.
Thank you, Counsel.
Quick rebuttal. First, I never knew a plaintiff lawyer that wouldn't settle a case because the damages were unliquidated because he's going to try to get interest. But secondly, he can't operate a law office very long with that. But secondly, even in that case, there is an exception in the statute that says that he can come in and say the prejudgment interest should stop. So that's protected.
What's the purpose of underinsured motorist coverage?
To give the guy out there on the street the ability to buy a policy that will cover him in the event the guy that hits him doesn't have enough insurance. Exactly what we have. And he can pay a premium, a big premium sometimes, to have that right, right, as stated in that contract.
How is that different from uninsured motors?
Virtually none, except this one in, underinsured is that the guy has some insurance and not enough.
Let me ask you some questions about situations where the insurance suit against the tortfeasor actually does go to judgment.
Okay.
And then it becomes clear that that there is underinsurance.
Okay.
I'm looking back at what this court wrote in Johnson and Higgins versus Kinnico, and what we were talking about in that case and also in Kavnar. We were talking about we fashioned common law prejudgment interest for two reasons, to encourage settlement and to expedite both settlements and trials by reducing incentives for defendants to delay.
Yes, ma'am.
How does that apply to an insurance company who can't pay until that case against the tortfeasor is resolved?
Okay. I think that's a very valid question. Let me answer it this way, if I may. That the, as in our case, until the tortfeasor, okay, when the tortfeasor case, in this case, they paid their money and they were out of it. Now we're dealing only with our own.
No, I'm not talking about your situation. I'm talking about my hypothetical.
Okay.
How do those incentives apply? Why are you charging prejudgment interest to the UMI carrier who is sitting out here while the tortfeasor's lawsuit's going on? The bill under the UMI is mounting, and the carrier is totally powerless to do anything about that.
That's correct, and that would be the choice, that, and it would also go to whether or not it was underinsured. And one of the purposes of this policy and the premium paid is to pay for that risk, because damages, as defined by the finance code, include prejudgment interest. And so it's a part of the damages, not just the use of money.
Well, I'm talking about the incentives that we pointed out.
Yes.
Those incentives apply to the two people in the tortfeasor case.
And ultimately
but it's a perverse incentive for the plaintiff in the tortfeasor case vis-a-vis its UIM coverage, because the plaintiff asked for 5 continuances, doesn't get the case to trial to 6-7 years.
Yes.
That's all at the expense of its UMI coverage.
That's correct. In that situation, I don't think they would probably owe attorney fees. I doubt if they would, because they wouldn't. If they paid the money when the case was over, the case against the tortfeasor, and they weren't denying it themselves. And what you were saying, that it would be correct. They would have no way to handle that because they weren't be the tortfeasor.
Should that be liable for the prejudgment interest?
Absolutely. It's part of the damages of what they're legally entitled to the tort. The defendant, I mean the plaintiff, is entitled to get that, absolutely. And I want to make one other comment, if I can, on the double recovery. Can I do that?
If you'll do it briefly.
Very briefly. On the double recovery, they're trying to make a claim on equity, not under the statute of an offset. They've not pled for it. They've not gone into the equities of what's right and wrong in this case. And it's not at the same statutory rate as is determined by as to be damages by the legislature. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted, and the court will take another brief recess.
Thank you.